If you're seeing blue in your social media feed, you might be wondering about blue zones. What are they? Why are they important? Today, we're going to focus on some key concepts from the Blue Zones book. Spoiler alert, we don't always agree with Dan Buettner's theories, but we'll translate blue zones into better brain health so you know exactly what to do. In the Brain Podcast, we blend medical insights with behavior design principles to empower you in creating brain healthy habits. We aim to demystify brain health, enhance focus, and reduce the risk of dementia. So join us as we unlock the secrets of the brain, all backed by science and fueled by behavior design.
I am Dr. Shabnam Das Kar. I'm a functional medicine doctor and a certified tiny habits coach. I teach people how to improve their focus, get rid of brain fog, and reduce their risk for dementia.
And I'm Andrea Spiros. I'm a behavior design consultant. I work with organizations to harness the power of high-performance habits to increase engagement, resilience, and well-being. So today we're talking about blue zones, and there's a lot of principles in blue zones. He has 9 different principles, and we're not going to talk about all of them, but should we maybe start with just listing them all? And then we can go into the ones that we are going to go deeper in.
Yes. And I think, Andrea, before we go into the principles, we probably need to explain what the blue zones are. And so basically, blue zones are, this is a journalist, Dan Buettner, who came up with this concept many years ago, where he looked at regions of the world where there were these people who were centenarians living much longer than average lifespan in these areas. And how the term blue came is because one of the researchers, he was like, circling these areas with a blue pencil or a blue pen. So this turned out to be blue zones. And again, which are those areas in the world? One thing I want to highlight is, so these areas are in Greece. It is Icaria, Sardinia in Italy, Loma Linda in California, Nicoya in Costa Rica, Okinawa in Japan. And recently in 2023, they've added Singapore to that list as well. So there is a Netflix documentary and a lot of things and beautiful books that have come out from. So what he basically wanted to share is, what do these people in these areas, where these parts of the world, where they lived so much longer, what did they do that probably would tell us what we can do for ourselves? So that is the part where Andrea and I will expand upon. And again, I need to mention that this is based on his observations. And in the research world, as all of you know, there is something called observational data, and in medicine, it is interventional data. Basically, observational data, we cannot really say that this is what exactly caused that. For example, we can't say that, we'll come through some of them. Drinking, wine every day caused them to live longer. We can't say that based on an observation trial. So, Andrea, what are the different things? And many of these things we've actually talked about before.
We have. We've talked about a lot of these. So, there's a wealth of information already. And many of them are very intuitive, I think, I'll say, which is why I think they resonate with people. But as you so rightly point out, that these are really just observational. He didn't do science to say, these are the 9 things that definitely make people live longer. He just looked at, what's going on in this area? What could it be? And then he created his own framework. Yeah. So the first one, in no particular order, the first one is move naturally. What's really behind that is, if you do things in your everyday life that are natural, like if you garden or if you walk someplace or bike someplace instead of taking a car, you're more likely to be healthier, right? The next is downshift. That is talking about reducing stress. I think we all know stress doesn't feel good. The next one is belonging. So that means you feel like you're part of some community. Another one is the right tribe, healthy food and activity, like being in a context where that is important. Loved ones first is the next one, which means you're prioritizing and you have a habit of connecting with others that are meaningful to you. The 80% rule is something out of Okinawa, which talks about your satiety level, how full you feel, and you only eat to 80% full. Plant is another one, which means having more vegetables than meat or animal products. Wine at 5 is another one, which you referred to, Shabnam, which many of these places have a habit of drinking wine in the evenings. And then the last one is know your purpose. That's something that your focus and your purpose in life and what you want to do. So those are the basic frameworks for the blue zones that he outlines. And he doesn't necessarily outline those for every single one, but it's a collective of you know, all the areas that he looked at. And then he thought, oh, these three are in this area, these three in this area. And so all together, they make the 9 types of thing. So should we start? Some of these we've already, you know, we already have movement podcasts. We already have stress podcast. We have a podcast on belonging with Amy Vest. We had a guest there. And some of these, like know your purpose, which is a wonderful thing to do, a little bit beyond the scope of what we can really focus on. In this, but that's a great bit to know where if you're feeling a little aimless to try to focus and you know, do some work on focusing your purpose. Where do you want to start? You want to start with the 80% rule? We're going to be very practical today. We're going to give you some actions on things you can actually take action on immediately so you can see some results.
Yeah, the 80% rule is like basically people are asked to eat to 80% of fullness. Now, Andrea, after reading that, I've tried to think, am I feeling 80% full? Am I feeling 100% full? It's very hard. So yes, satiety is very important. And we have talked about on other episodes about there are some foods. So if you look at food, proteins, fats, and carbohydrates, proteins are very satiating. So if we have a protein-forward meal, whether it is, you know, animal proteins or plant proteins, depending on what your preference is for. Proteins will keep us, you know, satiated much longer, and eating proteins first versus eating carbohydrates first. Fat has a little less satiating property, but it's more than carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are the least satiating. So, Andrea, that's the reason restaurants give us bread, first of all, because they want us to order more food. So, and here again, you know, Andrea and I always talk about some tiny habits, recipe or behavior change from the perspective of behavior change. I brought up bread at the restaurant. So what is it that we can do, Andrea, if I don't want to eat that bread?
Well, the first thing is if you can set up your context, right, your environment, just don't have the bread at the table. So you could have a tiny habit recipe of after the server offers me bread, I will say no, thank you. Right. So either they don't put it on your plate or they don't put the basket down. And a lot of places in the US will ask, like, do you want bread? And then you can say no, thank you for the table. Now, this does. You also have to get the buy-in to the other people at the table. Yeah. Right. But you can have a conversation about that. You could say, hey, I'm trying to eat a little more healthily for me and I don't want to fill up on bread. But is it OK with you if we don't get a basket of bread? Is it OK with you if you just put the bread on your plate so that it helps me do what I need to do, right? And if you have good friends, they're going to be okay with that. Yeah. So that's one thing that you can do. You know, another thing you can do is start to just track for yourself this 80% full, because it's going to mean, you know, there's not really a metric or a measure in, you know, of the world, right? It's for you. And so whatever it means to you is fine. I think we all know the over full, right? The we've had a holiday meal and our relatives are shoving food all around and making us finish our plates, that uncomfortable feeling, which is, I think everybody might agree, is well past 100% full, right? Yeah. And so just for yourself, you could, you know, after you finish a meal, you can ask yourself, after I finish my meal, after I put my fork down, after my last bite, I will ask myself, how full am I? Right. And create your own rating. You can actually probably find those online. When my kids were little, we had a scale of how hungry am I and how full am I? Right. And so you can just start to kind of calibrate for yourself how full you are and how what your satiety level is. And there's no, you know, I think that there's no hard and fast rule that, oh, if you're at 70% or 90%, you know, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
But that can give you a feeling of like, break the habit's not the best word, but stop you from eating more than you might normally if you just have a little more intention and consciousness around it, right? Yeah. If you have a focus.
Andrea, you brought up a very important point about awareness and consciousness. So this was a few years ago, and my mother-in-law was then, she was there. She passed away at the age of 94. She lived a very good life. So when I went to India, I would make it a point to sit with her for lunch. And then, you know, in the traditional Indian way, it's like there is food is on the table and I have to serve myself. And I realized that because I sat with her, there would always be rice. And I make it a point because I try to eat low carb. So I don't want to eat as much rice. And then I realized that if the rice is there on the table, I am going to take another helping. Mm-hmm. So I decided, no, what can I do? Because I can't expect my mother-in-law to change her, you know, habit from so many years. I said, okay, I don't have to necessarily eat with her. I can finish eating before and just sit with her at the table to give her company. Then I'm not tempted to eat that, you know, another helping of rice.
Yeah. And that this is the creativity around is when you design for your behavior, as opposed to leave it to chance, you can do things like that. And that worked for you. Right. Yeah. And it's always good to try something and then see if it works. And if it works, great. If not, you can say like, oh, you know what? I'm still eating the rice. You know, I'm picking. Well, maybe I can put the rice on the other side of the table.
Yeah.
Maybe I can put the serving spoon far away or, you know, something like that and get a little creative. Or maybe every time I'm tempted to reach for the rice, I'll remind myself that I'm not really hungry anymore. But there's many ways to design for your behavior, and it's always going to be more effective than leaving it for chance.
Yes, absolutely.
You could be like
this decision.
People would do that. They would feel like, oh, I'm very frustrated with myself. Why do I keep eating the rice? Yeah. And what's wrong with me? Right.
Yeah. The conversation should not be what is wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with us.
No.
It's the way it is. And Andrea, at the beginning, you talked about, you know, movement, naturally movement. Mm-hmm. One of the things that some of these people were, there was, I forget which particular place. So this lady used to go to the church every day. And for her, her church was uphill. And she would walk to the church. So it's not like she decided to wake up in the morning and said, I need to go for a walk. Her thing was to go to the church because religion was something important to her. And her environment is naturally designed in such a way that she had to walk uphill.
Right. Yeah. And for many years, I lived in a place that was relatively flat. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't going to be an option for me to walk uphill. And I think, you know, in Dan Buettner's observation, they talk about, well, the more steps in a village, the longer the lifespan. Mm-hmm. But there were also other things that were going on in that village. So if you live in a flat place, don't freak out. I want to just say, you know, in the 80% rule too, just a little asterisk here is that, you know, if you have some stress eating issues, some emotional eating issues, some food addiction issues, the 80% rule and touching in with yourself is a great thing to do, to say, you know, how full am I? How hungry am I, type of thing. But please don't put pressure on yourself to withhold food or make yourself bad or wrong for actually eating food when you're not hungry or, you know, going beyond 80%. Like, you don't need that judgment. You don't need that blame, shame, or guilt piled onto you. You know, simply noticing where you are might be very helpful, but, you know, address those issues separately so that you can be healthy in that way. That's the best thing you can do for yourself.
Emotional part of eating is something that, you know, like I always say, in medicine, we were not taught anything about food at all. And unless someone's a psychiatrist, I'm sure they have never been taught about the challenge people have with their relationships. So things like food addiction. Now, food addiction is it's not something that someone can overcome serious addictions by just, you know, oh, you're just going to use more motivation and willpower to will yourself out of it. No, if you need expert help, and there are ways to screen for these conditions. Important point to, again, observation and review. It's like, if you feel like eating something that you hadn't planned, ask yourself, why do you want to do that? Are you bored? Someone like me who works a lot from home, for me, it is like because the pantry is just there, you know, like, okay, I've done something and I need a change. No, now the change could be a walk, but instead of a walk, I'll, you know, head for the bag of nuts.
Food tastes better than a walk, I'll tell you that. It's much more delicious, right? And again, I think the point is really, really important too. It's like, the phrase, why am I eating, is a great phrase. And again, it's okay to eat afterwards. But if you just ask yourself, why am I eating? It will help you identify, like, oh, I'm bored. Oh, I need a change. Oh, I feel stressed. Oh, I feel uncomfortable. And you can still eat, but it will just help you kind of untangle give you a little pause to have some more agency, because maybe if you ask yourself that question, you will then make a different choice. But if you still eat, it's okay. Because like I said, nothing tastes, no, a walk or anything else does not taste as delicious as a donut or nuts.
And another important thing, Andrea, is like, let us say if you decide to eat and you ask yourself and you find that you're hungry. So as a functional medicine doctor, I would go upstream and find out, why are you feeling hungry? Are you not eating enough at the last meal?
Right.
And another thing, Andrea, which recently I was talking to somebody, and when I ask my patients, you know, why do you need that snack at, you know, 4 p.m. with your tea? In many places in the world, in India, it's like a habit. They'll have a cookie or a biscuit with that tea. I said, do you really need that? Like, what will happen if you don't have it? Just have the tea. You don't have anything else. And she said, doctor, this is the first time actually I'm thinking about it. I don't really know why I'm having that. I think it's just became a habit in our family.
Right.
And another thing, Andrea, which many people think it's a great idea, and I'm not so sure it works very well, is one lady said, oh, I want to reduce my thing of eating cookies. So I'm going to eat a celery stick instead of
Oh my gosh, I don't agree with that.
So, Andrea, what would you suggest to somebody like that?
I would say eat the cookie or don't eat the cookie. Like, I literally would say, like, eat the cookie without guilt, shame, blame, or judgment. Just enjoy it, or decide not to. Or, you know, I think the bigger untangling something like that, you know, is think about how many times a day are you having cookies, right? If you're having cookies 10 times a day, then look at each individual instance as one design challenge.
Yeah.
And pick the easiest instance where you can say, you know what, I don't really need that cookie at 10 a.m. And then see if you can design so that you're not having that cookie, right? But pick the easiest time of the day, right? And then celebrate that success. So maybe if it's on the, you know, if you're driving to work at a certain time and you have cookies in the car, maybe you can just keep the cookies out of the car, drive to work one day without the cookies and see how it goes, right?
Yeah,
and then if you do it, you have a success and you can build some success. Yes. Them. But start with the easiest, don't start with the hardest. Yeah. And then think about every time you have a cookie as a different design issue, right? Not one habit, it's like nine different habits. And that will help you in untangling that cookie thing. Now, if you're just having one cookie a day, I would just examine, like, is that really something you need to do? And obviously, if you're a diabetic or if it's throwing you off in some way, you know what's best for you. But again, it's a design issue that you can design for. But the last thing I would do is swap it for something that's far less delicious.
Yeah. That usually doesn't work. The other thing is, I would, again, we talked about changing your environment. So setting yourself up for success. Mm-hmm. I can tell my patients, maybe because it's easier, just don't get the cookie home. And if you are the one baking it, then don't bake. Oh, other people in the house want to have cookies. I said, no, that is a different conversation.
Yes.
If you are the one buying or making the, you know, decisions, it's like, don't bring it home. And this is one challenge that, you know, I realized if I go to even a health food store, and health food stores don't necessarily always have heavy, absolutely healthy food. It's the challenge with all the gluten-free cookies. Like they are gluten-free, but they still have sugar.
Exactly.
They still have carbohydrates, and they still taste very good.
Exactly. So it doesn't necessarily make them healthy all of a sudden. No. It just helps people who do want something and have, you know, are celiac or gluten intolerant or something like that to have them. And I think this is important. I often say setting up your context is really important. Yes. And a lot of times people will say, well, people who don't do those things, really the first thing is that their environment doesn't include those things. So people who don't eat cookies every day just don't have cookies in the house. And as you rightly point out, other people are in your home. So I say there's three things people can do when they're changing their environment or setting their environment up is to set up, skill up, and speak up.
Right? Oh, so wow.
Set up, skill up, and speak up. So set up means get your environment the way you like it, right? So like don't have the cookies, have all the food in your pantry that's on your game plan that you can eat, and you don't have to worry about nothing that you're craving, or, you know, set it up the way it works for you. Then whatever, and this is not just for food, but just for whatever. And then skill up. So if you have to learn a new skill or refine an existing skill, then do that, right? So if you want to be more plant forward, then maybe you need to take a cooking class on how to cook more vegetables, or maybe you just need to find some recipes and cook them a few times so that they become easy for you to do. So then you're more likely to do them. So that's skill up. And then the last one is speak up. And sometimes they all kind of work together. And that is really having the conversations you need to have so that everybody's on the same page. And this is not like a lecture or anything. It's if you live with other people, if you live with family members, with kids, with parents, then you could say, hey, I'm really wanting to eat more healthy and eat in this way. And these cookies in the house are making it challenging for me. Is it okay if we don't buy those cookies? Or I know I always make cookies for you on Sundays, and I know you all really enjoy them, but I'm having trouble because I eat the cookie dough and then, you know, they're around the house and I nosh on them and I really don't end up feeling good. Is it okay that we just do that maybe once a month? Or is it okay if we don't do that at all? Right? Because this is what I'm hoping to do. And, you know, if people who love you will work it out with you.
Yeah. And I think another important thing which sometimes people forget is if I am on a health journey, I want everybody in my home to be a part of it. Yes, for sure. But me trying to, like you said, you know, lecturing them or telling them you should do this in the tiny house world, we don't talk about shoulds.
Nope.
It's like if you say the way Andrea said, you know, I am on a health journey and having the cookies at home, it makes it very difficult for me not to eat them. So I need your help. Can you help me do this? It's a much better conversation than, oh, we should not, all of us should stop eating cookies and don't you know it, you know?
Exactly. And then you work it out with them as to how it can work for everybody.
Yeah.
But usually your loved ones really want to support you in being healthy because it means you get to show up for them even better and they get a better version of you. And oftentimes you'd be surprised because maybe someone in your house will be like, you know what? I don't feel great eating those cookies, but when they're around, I do the same thing. Yeah. Let's not have those cookies. Right. So that actually kind of brings us into the plant slant since we're talking about right.
Yeah.
And now I think Blue Zones is very anti under the surface. I think it's very anti animal products. I'm not personally anti animal products. I eat a lot of veg. Everybody's got to work with what's right for them. Some people feel better with some animal protein, not a lot. Some people, it's all very different. So you're going to sort that out for yourself. But overall, a slant of having more veg is going to be healthier for you, and then obviously less processed food is a little on the spectrum, right?
Yeah. So all these people in the blue zones, as Dan Buettner mentioned in his book and documentary, they don't eat, number one, they don't eat a lot of processed food. Another thing, Andrea, I noticed is many of them are like, they are quite poor. Mm-hmm. So this meat and plant conversation that we're having, see, meat and fish and any of these animal proteins cost more. So people usually eat what is locally and easily available. And again, all of them were not vegetarians.
No, I mean, there's sheep farmers in Ikaria and yeah. the fishermen and things like that. They are eating those foods. They're not vegetarian.
No.
They're growing and eating the foods and they're local. So this is not about, you know, you have to be a vegetarian. But no. in the U.S. in particular, where many people do not eat many vegetables at all, except for yeah. a French fry.
Yeah, which we don't consider a vegetable.
Yeah.
yeah, like places like Okinawa, these are like they ate a lot of seafood, obviously. Mm-hmm. So that is the important thing that, you know, sometimes this is what I always talk about is we focus on, oh, this is the Mediterranean diet or the Paleolithic right. diet, or people talk about what is in the diet. And I also want to highlight what is not included in that. Like all these, you know, different diets that people talk about are healthier. Right. They don't have processed food. They don't have a lot of sugar. They don't have, many of these places don't have easy availability. Like they wanted to eat something, they would have to make it from scratch.
Right.
And do you remember, Andrea, was it some kind of bread which took about 8 hours to make?
Yeah, there was some kind of bread and really takes yeah. a very long time.
So in our modern lives, some people might love doing that, but I don't see myself, you know, I don't like cooking. So I don't see myself cooking anything from scratch to eat healthier.
Right.
Whereas I'm fine with, you know, like you said, you know, learning something new, which is short. Like, how do I look for recipes? It's like ingredient list and the prep time and cooking time.
Yeah. And that's what many people need to do. You know, yeah. there's a lot of sheet pan recipes and things like
yeah.
that. What I've found too is when I find a recipe that I like, I make it in quick succession. So maybe okay. I make it 4 weeks in a row, or I make it on Monday and then I make it on Friday. And especially with a new recipe, because then the first time it's forever, it takes forever. There's this, I'm looking back at the recipe and what do I need? Do I get this? I chop it. How much, right? It just takes forever. Then the second time, it's a little faster. I feel a little more competent. And then by the third or fourth time, I'm really good at it. And I feel like, wow, this doesn't take so long. What was my problem? Right? Why did, and that helps you. That's first of all, a version of skilling up, right?
Yeah. Getting
skills. And then it makes it easier to do. So you're more likely to do it the next time, right?
Yeah.
So that once I realize like, oh, that really only took 15 minutes. Or what happens is then I have the ingredients in my head. So when I'm at the store, I can say, oh, I need parsley and cauliflower and dates, right? And you just need to bring those in and I have everything else that I need for the recipe. And it makes it easier to do, right? So I'm not having to say, oh, I got to look for this and what do I need? And I forgot one thing. And it makes it hard to do. So the easier you can make it for yourself and find recipes that do, like you said, don't take the recipes that are like an hour long and you got to stir it, and pick the recipes that work for you. Find a style of recipe. Maybe it's braising. Maybe it's a slow cooker. Maybe it's a sheet pan recipe. All those things will help you keep your healthier lifestyle that you want to do. And you could even add a habit of like Sunday night or Sunday afternoon after I put the last dish in the dishwasher Sunday morning after breakfast or brunch, I will look at the week and decide what we might eat, or look in the fridge and decide one thing that I might eat. The best tiny habit recipe that I was a random one that another coach gave me, because I told her I was, you know, I'm a grown up here, but I told her dinner always surprised me. Right. You know, dinner is not something that's random. It's every day. And, you know, I every day I'd be like, oh my God, dinner, as if it were, you know, I'd never had to make dinner before. And she said, I know what you mean. You're not alone. Here's what I do. After I, you know, pour my cup of coffee, I open the fridge and decide what's for dinner, even if that means ordering out.
Yeah.
So she'd have her coffee, she'd open the fridge, look around and be like, okay, you know, there's leftover this, or there's, you know, this that I can cook, or she'd be like, there's nothing in there. We're ordering pizza, Thai food, Chinese, whatever. She would just make that decision. And I have to tell you, simply by making that decision, I had a domino effect through my day. So if I decided, okay, we're having a cauliflower saute or cauliflower stir fry, I then, without even thinking, when I had my lunch, I would grab the cauliflower out and prep it or whatever the things and prep it and then put it back in. I wouldn't even have to plan for it. It just naturally would happen. And it just released a lot of the tension from my non-conscious tension from the day. Yeah. Even if I knew, okay, I'm ordering pizza tonight, right? There's a freedom in it. So I encourage you to try that. Or you, if you really want to be more plant slant or cooking, so you're not doing as many processed foods, you can say, after I walk into the grocery store, I will turn in the direction of the produce and pick one vegetable for me to try, right? It might be a process where if you don't eat a lot of vegetables, you might just have to pick one recipe a week on, you know, Sunday night or Saturday, whatever your best time is, and say, I will pick a recipe that's a vegetable and a recipe that I like, and I will, you know, go to the store and get those things.
Yeah. Right?
So you can make it a process.
Preparation, as you rightly pointed out, Andrea, and again, I understand like this challenge that you're talking about, you know, we have to make dinner. That was a common challenge for me. It's like, oh my God, I did not thaw any food. Like, what are you going to eat?
Right.
So I made it a point to have eggs as a backup because eggs won't need thawing or anything. And also like, you know, keeping some food, whatever you love, as a backup so that, you know, on these days when the crisis mode strikes, oh my God, it's like dinner time and I don't have anything ready.
Right, right.
And it also, like you said, it could be that you had already planned to eat outside. Like I recently started ordering food from a, you know, this is a ready meal, you know, company.
Meal kit.
Yeah. And I realized that I end up eating more vegetables and it's not a meal kit, like it's cooked and their food is tasty and it's cooked in olive oil. So I realized I was eating more vegetables because their recipes were way tastier.
That's funny. That's funny.
I know. And I thought, oh, this is way simpler than, you know, trying to, because I don't like cooking. So that's a big thing. So find out what it is for yourself. If you love cooking, congratulations, good on you. But if you're like me, you don't like cooking, find other ways. You know, there are so many ways. There's no one right way.
Exactly. And for me, a while back, I started getting a meal kit 3 times a week because then I would know I could experiment with different types of food and not have a lot of waste. Yeah. Right. So I could have a Thai curry and an Indian curry and, you know, some other style of, you know, even just a hamburger and more in a more complete meal with the side and with the veg and things like that. And it also allowed me to easily experience different cooking styles so that then it was a way for me to skill up. And I also kind of embedded the cooking times for things in there. So no longer had to look. So I know a chicken breast, if I'm going to put it in the oven, I sear it on this side for so many minutes and then turn it over. And then I put it in the oven for so many minutes. Or if I'm searing it on both sides, I do it this many minutes and that many minutes. And, you know, whatever I was cooking, I understood the time frame. So I no longer had to look at a recipe.
Yeah.
It made cooking easier for me. It also, they come together really quickly. And I'm not saying everyone should do this, but they came together very quickly so that I could, if my day, you know, ran a little bit long, which it often did, I could in 15, 20 minutes have a nice dinner on the table for my family. And then the other days I could cook and have leftovers and things like that. And then some of the things I learned recipes from them. So now I can just make them myself. I know, oh, I could get this vegetable, that vegetable, and this seasoning, put them all together and add this on it. And now I learned some new recipes along the way. So there is no one right way.
No.
You just do what works for you and just take next steps. That's really the most important thing is take next steps.
Yeah. So Andrea, are we going to talk about wine at 5 next?
I think we should because that is, there's a lot of controversy around that. You know, in the olden days, the way olden days, people drank and smoked throughout all their pregnancies. And now it's the other way where, you know, if you even have a glass of wine in front of you, someone is going to, you know, call Child Protective Services. So why don't we talk about where you stand with that?
Okay. So first and foremost, this is what scientific studies say. The safest amount of alcohol is zero. Now, we all of us know that. And I love red wine. So it's not like I'm this pontificating doctor talking about alcohol. But again, you know, like in Canada, they have a there's a scale of low risk, high risk, and very high risk of drinking. Mm-hmm. So obviously, where on the spectrum someone is. And, you know, drinking, if it's like, you know, unless it becomes socially unacceptable, like smoking, it's not going to go away.
No.
So how can, and here again, Andrea and I are not talking about alcohol use disorder. People who have that problem, they need to go for expert help.
Exactly.
Here we're talking about, you know, enjoying that glass of red wine with your food. And instead of one glass, you open a bottle so you can feel like, you know, two of you are at home. This is what happens to us. And we can finish the bottle. Yeah. I wish they would make smaller bottles, but they don't. So one of the things we disagree with, you know, Dan Buettner is have a big one dozen of the favorite red wine. You keep it at home. If I am trying to reduce my alcohol intake, I would make sure that I don't have easy access to alcohol at home.
Right.
Like instead of buying like, you know, one dozen bottles or half a dozen bottles, I would probably buy just one. And again, there are different ways of doing it. It's like, but what Andrea and I want to say is we disagree with the wine at, you know, that is not a health. Because many people, I've been told so many times, Andrea, oh, but everyone says, you know, one alcoholic drink a day is healthy. No, it is not healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And that's one of the ways.
Another thing Andrea realized is he's talking about wine at 5. So again, having it earlier in the day, and none of these people where he talked about, you know, having wine, they were not eating, just drinking just the wine. They had it with food.
No.
So with food and having just alcoholic drinks by themselves with some high carbohydrate snacks, it's very different. And the later in the day we, you know, have alcohol or even food, the more difficult it is to process, particularly in relation to blood glucose levels, inflammation, sleep, everything goes haywire. So yes, if you would like to, and I know it's not always possible for people to have wine at 5. Many people don't even get home. So,
right.
But to know that earlier in the day is better than later on in the evening. So those are like small things. And sometimes, Andrea, I'm so surprised when people tell me, I didn't know that.
Right? There's so many simple things, and we're not encouraging day drinking, but
no.
I also think the title of this Wine at 5 is also partly marketing, right?
Yeah.
Because Wine at 8 doesn't sound as great.
No.
Right? Or wine at 2, you know?
So
I think a lot of this is a little bit of marketing, and it's not like you're taking medicine. If you're not a wine drinker, you should not necessarily go and buy a bottle and start drinking wine every day.
No, that is not what we are talking. We don't recommend.
Exactly.
So before we end the episode, I just want to highlight about Singapore, because see, all these other places are like, they grow their own food. They, you know, they have like, they're naturally active, all those things. Singapore joined the Blue Zones in 2023, and Singapore doesn't grow anything locally. Like everything has to come from outside. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, Andrea, which I thought was like really very important, is one of the researchers from Singapore, what she said is initially they focused more on education. And mm-hmm. in the Tiny Habits world, we always say, you know, information action fallacy is what Dr. B.J. Fogg calls it.
Right.
We just give people more information and we automatically assume they're going to take action.
Right.
And so what this lady said is they realized that education was not enough, but that didn't work. So education didn't work as well as wanted. So we decided to change the environment instead to make the healthy choice easier. And I thought, oh my God, this is like so profound, because this is what we talk about. So Singapore has these, you know, public transport is really very, and I had been to Singapore many years ago. It's like clean, sanitized place. And there are parks and walkable places very near all these apartment complexes. People can walk to any place or they can use public transport. And in fact, to use private cars, they have to pay quite a lot of money for that. And it is designed in a way where people can walk to places. They meet other people. Like, then younger people are, you know, given discounts if they want to buy an apartment near their parents' place so that they can communicate with them more often. So And Singapore has a fantastic healthcare system. So it's like so many things that come together. So it's not necessary. Singapore is a very modern place. It's not necessary. We have to move to some remote corner of the world where there's no internet.
And that is really the, you know, the environment shaping, you know, how a decision can be, you know, made easier. Yeah. And obviously we're not going to change, you know, we can't change every country in the world. Some countries are already setting that up, but just being conscious of that, you can create your own environment for that. And really a lot of these places, a lot of other places in the world outside the US don't, you know, eat a little more locally, have the farmer's market is more of the norm than the grocery store. It may probably not even have prepackaged, you know, food that are more processed, you know, the sliced, cut up, rinsed, things like that. But again, don't make yourself bad or wrong for using those things.
Yeah. Right?
It's totally fine. If you need to buy some prepackaged, you know, veg so that you actually cook it, good for you.
Yeah. Like chopped frozen vegetables. Frozen vegetables don't lose their nutrients.
Right.
Because then you're not going to waste food because, as you know, fresh food is going to, if you don't use it. Oh, exactly. One more thing, Andrea, like I just want to mention at the end, one of the places in the US is Loma Linda.
Right.
Now, they are religious, but you know, one very interesting statistics. So one of the most popular places after the church for these people in Loma Linda was the local gym.
Right.
So movement. And I think, so Andrea, what are the things we talked about today? We're going to, I think, let's conclude our
we talked about what a blue zone is. And a blue zone were these areas where a researcher noticed that they had an unusually high number of people living past 100. And he stamped a little blue dot on there. So that's how they got their names. And Dan Buettner started going to these places and trying to put his own framework on why, through observation, why these people were living longer. He came up with this framework that he talked about and that we've shared: move naturally, reduce stress, belonging, right tribe, love ones first, 80% rule, plant slant, wine at five, and know your purpose. And then we've honed in, we do have some podcasts on a lot of those that you can go in and into our catalog and listen to those. We talked today predominantly about the 80% rule. We talked about a plant slant, although we're not making animal protein bad. Wine at five, how we kind of disagree with that. And gave you some practical action steps that you can take to make these things happen. So it's not just information that goes in one ear and out the other, and then you end up feeling bad. So we appreciate your listening today. We hope you implement some of the tactics and strategies that we're sharing with you. If you like this, please like, rate, share, subscribe so you can learn more and let us know how you do.
Thank you, and bye now.